From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. On June 25th, 2009, I was with a group of my college students when I heard of the death of Michael Jackson. A couple of them were surprised that I was upset. They said, "He's just some child molester." Well, that made me even sadder, that this great musical genius had been reduced to this. My guest, journalist Steve Knopper, has done his part to reverse this cruel injustice to Michael Jackson's musical legacy. Steve Knopper is a Rolling Stone contributing editor and the author of Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Business in the Digital Age. His new book is MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson. Steve Knopper, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
I suppose the person who's most responsible for the damage to Michael Jackson's musical legacy is in Michael Jackson. In examining his childhood, did you discover any clues to his personality idiosyncrasies?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that I would... I guess you could say that Michael Jackson was sort of to blame for some of the bad things that happened to him, but, you know, I certainly financially that was true, and but really I think that a lot of his life was, you know, people who misunderstood him. I mean, certainly at the beginning of his life, as you suggest, he was the victim of physical abuse, or so he would say many years later, at the hands of his father, Joe Jackson. And he kind of grew up in this childhood environment, kind of believing that there weren't many people he could trust. And so I do think that led him to grow older with, he would always say he didn't have a real childhood because he was a show business star. But I think a lot of the reason was that he just grew up with a lot of suspicion and you know, never quite got over that.
You said, you had a little caveat there about his abuse. Do you believe he was abused as a child?
I do believe he was abused as a child. I mean, the caveat is only that the only real source for that is Michael himself. You know, Michael, in a 1993 interview with Oprah Winfrey, was incredibly specific about the violence that he said he experienced at the hands of his father. He said that his father beat him with iron cords and you know, a lot of other things happened. Actually, that's not true. I mean, there are people who I talked to in my book who said that they witnessed some of this abuse. But Michael is kind of the primary source for that. You know, his brothers and other people in the family, Joe, in fact, after Michael made these accusations, said, "Well, I didn't beat him. I whooped him, and there's a difference."
Mm.
And his brother, a couple of his brothers, Marlon, Jermaine, some others have sort of said they agree with that, and that Joe was just incredibly strict because he had to be in that time in Gary, Indiana, in the late 50s and early 60s, in order to keep his children away from drugs and gangs and violence on the streets. And to that, you know, to that end, he succeeded. I'm not sure I buy that argument.
Yeah. Well, what about when they came to California? Michael was still a little boy when they came out here, right?
He was. That's right. He was only 9 or 10 years old, correct.
And I don't know. I'm sure that his upbringing was weird then, too, because he was, as you said, he was in show business. But would his father continue to physically abuse him at that point?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. You know, that is certainly what some of my sources told me in the book, that the abuse continued in some degree or the other all the way up through the early days of the Jackson 5 recording for Motown.
Well, I want to talk a lot about his music, but let's get some of these kind of strange things out of the way first. Now, in your book, you said, and I don't know exactly how you said it, but you said something about how, you know, Michael Jackson did a lot to break down the barriers between race, not just with music, but also physically by his many plastic surgeries. And you also said in the book that he, during his lifetime, admitted to two, but that there was many, many, many. Do you believe that he had a problem with his own features because they were African-American features?
No, I'm not sure. You know, there's a line of discussion with regard to Michael Jackson about how he is sort of a race traitor, and he lightened his skin and did various things to his face in order to sort of abandon his own African-American identity. I don't really think that that's true. And in fact, you know, the reason he lightened his skin by all evidence is that he suffered from this skin disease called vitiligo. And it was a very painful, uncomfortable disease. And he, you know, since he was such a public figure, instead of trying to wake up every morning and kind of match the new shade of the blotches on his skin in order to kind of cover it up and, you know, get the correct shade, he just decided it would be easier to lighten his skin. You know, you can criticize that decision, but I do think that the vitiligo was driving this whatever he was doing to as far as his color went. And then as far as his face goes, you know, what my theory in the book is sort of that Michael Jackson came from a very limited frame of reference. You know, he grew up in this neighborhood in Gary, Indiana that was very segregated. It was a pure African-American neighborhood. It was a life of poverty, and he didn't have much. And as he grows older and he becomes more successful, more powerful, has more money, he starts to kind of design this more limitless world for himself. And that lack of limitations extended into a bunch of different areas. And one was, you know, philosophically, limitations on race. You know, he continually said throughout his life, particularly in the song Black or White, where he said it explicitly, that it didn't matter if you were black or white. He just didn't want to see racial boundaries. As far as, you know, limitations on his face, I think he kind of transcended that by constantly tinkering with his face. I think you can make an argument that he saw his face as something that was kind of malleable, something that could change. You know, he started out with a couple of facial surgeries for a variety of reasons, and then he just kept going with it.
Yeah, he sure did. Now, one of the rumors you dispel in your book is that he had no nose.
Right.
He actually did have a nose.
He did. I mean, if you believe the coroner, you know, if you believe the Los Angeles County coroner who I spoke with and I read the coroner's report on his death, both the report and the coroner himself are adamant that Michael, despite certain reports, did have an actual nose when he died.
We're talking with Steve Knopper, and he's a music journalist, and he's just written this biography of Michael Jackson that's really great. It's called MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson. So one more tabloid question, and then we'll talk
sure.
more about his music. So, you know, one of the things that has hung over his life was that he was a child molester or that he spent inappropriate time with children in bed. You don't have any comments about that?
Yeah, I mean, my conclusion in the book is that, you know, even though I am sympathetic to the point of view that if a child accuses an adult of abuse, certainly sexual abuse, you have to take what that child says very seriously. I believe that any journalist or any writer who's writing about Michael Jackson and getting into these accusations has to face the idea that he was found not guilty by a court, by a jury in 2005 in what, you know, the evidence shows and the record shows was a very fair trial. I don't think the jury was gamed or bought in any way. There was certainly a vigorous and expensive defense by Tom Mesereau and his team, but there was also a very vigorous prosecution. So, you know, I think in the end, this not guilty verdict, if you're going to write about Michael Jackson and say, okay, well, that not guilty verdict is unreasonable, you better have some proof. You better have some evidence that suggests otherwise. And certainly in my research, I was not able to come up with that kind of evidence, and several, many other writers have come to the same conclusion. So, yes, I do believe that that verdict was the correct verdict. And then in my book, in addition to that, I mean, despite that, I do think that Michael was guilty of questionable judgment. You know, and other writers have said this too, but he should not have gone, for example, on international television and said that he, you know, slept with children in the same bed. He shouldn't have done that in the first place, and then kind of bragged about it as if this was kind of the thing that many people should do if they're grown adults.
But since Michael never had a childhood, maybe it was the other way around. He never had an adulthood. It's probably more likely.
Could be right.
Yeah. Do you think that he was the victim of extortion or, you know, attempted blackmails and things of that nature, and that's how these things got started?
Extortion by who? By the accusers?
Yeah.
Child molestation accusers?
Parents?
Yeah, I mean, I do think so. I think that in certain cases, particularly if you really study the record of the family, the child that accused him in what became the 2005 trial, I think that this was not the correct family to have been taking this case to court, to a jury. You know, this was a family that had a lot of questionable decisions in their past. They all accounts suggest that this family really liked the gifts and the money that Michael was giving them, and when that spigot kind of turned off, they kind of turned around and made these accusations. And I think you can make that argument, although I wasn't there, you know, I'm just kind of telling you what I've read and what the evidence was, but I think you can make the argument with others who have accused Michael in the past as well.
Well, Steve Knopper, let's talk about the music of Michael Jackson. And I think everybody knows, I think it's almost like the Beatles in that the big hits are in everyone's blood. But what about, you pointed out in your book that the posthumous releases of Michael's have been kind of disappointing. So in within the catalog of music that he released in his lifetime from the Jackson 5 until his death in 2009, did you find some great, great music that has been overlooked?
You mean from the stuff that actually came out?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I get a lot of questions of sort of, wasn't Thriller great, and didn't he decline after Thriller? And, I'm not the first critic to say, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think that Bad was a great album, Dangerous was a great album. I think History, which came out in 95, was an up-and-down album, but had a lot of great moments on it. And I think Invincible, his final studio album in 2001, was very underrated. It was kind of a different feel, a different sound for him, and really sounds great today.
Well, why don't you think he made more music?
You know, Michael was a perfectionist. I sort of feel like he was more like, say, Bruce Springsteen and less like, for example, Prince. So Prince was someone who was so prolific and continues to be someone who's so prolific that he's just sort of like, everything I do should be out,
Right.
And Prince is a perfectionist as well. He's a genius as well. But, he puts out incredible volumes of music. Ryan Adams, someone like that, it just keeps spewing out stuff. Lil Wayne. And then there's this other kind of point of view that takes the view of sort of, well, if I make 100 tracks, I and my whole team of experienced people is going to just whittle and whittle and whittle until we get down to the 10 or 12 that are going to be on the album, and those are going to be so absolutely perfect that, we're going to we're just going to have this pure pop album. And I think that was much more how Michael operated.
Well, of course, the Beatles made all of their music, and it's all pretty great, in a period of 8 years. So it is possible to make more music and have it still be great.
That's true. That's true. I mean, yeah, I just think it comes, the Beatles certainly had this spurt of like you say, their early albums, it was just one thing after another. I mean, but on the other hand, all those albums had those early albums had 10 or 12 songs each. So it by today's standards, it was not as much material, but still, I think that Michael was kind of had the different point of view. I think he and his people too, Quincy Jones and others that he would work with over the years, just had the point of view of, let's really hone this down and put only the best stuff out.
Well, let's talk about that moment that I think is the moment in which Michael emerged as a full blown adult entertainer, and that was in 1983 when he appeared on the Motown special, first with his brothers and then doing Billie Jean solo. How did that come about, and how was that moment created?
Yeah, sure. So Motown was kind of, its star had faded, its star power had faded by the early 80s. It was considered a label that was doing great music in the 60s, but beyond that, not so much. And so by the early 80s, it was a little bit of a nostalgia trip, and Berry Gordy and his people wanted to reunite everybody. They wanted to get the Supremes back together and the Temptations back together and Marvin Gaye to come back and be on stage and all the great old names. And so, of course, Michael Jackson, who was just turning into a major, major solo star, the future king of pop at that moment, Berry and his people approached Michael. And there's a variety of different versions of the story as to how Berry approached him. It depends who you ask. Germain would say in his book that Michael didn't want to do it until his mother, Catherine, kind of convinced him to do it. I've talked to other sources who suggested that Michael wanted to do it all along. you know, and ultimately, no matter what story you believe, it all ends in the same way, which is that Michael said, you know, okay, I'll do it, but I want to do one of my solo songs that has nothing to do with Motown. And that, of course, became Billie Jean, and that became the iconic Moonwalk performance.
You know, when I see Michael dance, I see this incredible originality, but I also see not just James Brown and Jackie Wilson, but you can also see the Nicholas Brothers and Tip Tap and Toe and some of the older African-American performers from the 30s and 40s. Did Michael study them? Did he know about all
Absolutely those? He did. I'm glad you mentioned the Nicholas Brothers, because the Nicholas Brothers were actually some of the... They were a guest on the Jacksons TV show on CBS in the 70s. And they came on and did this amazing tap dancing routine, which I encourage everybody to look up on YouTube. You know, it was... Michael took everything in. He was just a sponge through most of his youth and even beyond. And he had this sort of perfect pitch for dance, even at a very young age, where he could kind of watch something once and do a little bit of work on it and then just be able to mimic it perfectly. And so but what was great, I mean, that's kind of a unique talent, but what was great about Michael's career was that, especially early on, is that he had access directly to all these amazing performers. I mean, he was playing shows on the Chitlin' circuit in the 60s, where James Brown would show up and Jackie Wilson and the Temptations and all those guys. And then he was watching Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly in the old musical movies. And then he was, you know, in the 70s, all these amazing dancers were coming. And then he would, even beyond that, he started to meet the Soul Train dancers. You know, the Jackson 5 would perform on Soul Train, and there were no better dancers in the world, you could argue, in the early 70s than the people that were performing regularly on Soul Train. And so Michael was learning from them. Specifically, he learned the robot from Soul Train, which was the dance that, of course, he did with Dancing Machine on Soul Train and elsewhere. And, you know, I make the argument in the book, and I think a lot of dancers support this, that the robot was sort of like a transition to some of the even more exciting ideas that he would do later, certainly the moonwalk.
We're talking with Steve Knopper, and he's the author of MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. The moonwalk, you know, that's a marvelous and awe-inspiring. It still gives you kind of a chill when you see him do it, you know. But a little bit later on, when he was like grabbing his crotch and stuff, maybe that didn't go over quite as well. What was that all about?
Yeah, I mean, that he started to do that move in the late 80s, early 90s, and you know, he was just kind of expressing himself. He just started to kind of do that on stage. There was a moment when he started to do it for the Black or White video, which was directed by John Landis, the director who did Thriller, as well as the movies Animal House and Blues Brothers and so forth. And Landis kind of stopped him at that point, even though Michael had been doing that move for a while. And he said, you know, Michael, no, you know, you can't do that. You can't just stick your hand down your pants and grab your crotch, you know. You know, famously, there is a quote by one of Michael's managers at the time who said, you know, Michael called the manager to sort of like intervene in this conflict. And the manager said, you know, do it, Michael, do it more. And I guess I would argue that, that you know, Michael's instinct turned out to be correct, because that move, even though it seemed so dirty and risque at the time, perverted, I certainly think it's really great to watch now. It's really part of his whole thing.
Every dancer does it. In fact, I'm doing it right now.
Me too.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what happened. You know, I mean, it's not that he didn't make great music after Thriller, but his career. I mean, how did he react to this explosion of fame that followed Thriller? I mean, that was really far more than he had experienced before, or that anybody had experienced before.
That's correct, yeah. And at first, I think he handled it really well. I think he had a lot of good people that he could trust around him. You know, certainly his manager, Frank DeLeo, was very, very supportive for a long time. And DeLeo was somebody who had music business ties and was connected. He had been a promotional executive for Michael's label, Epic Records. And so he could sort of speak the language. He could translate what Michael wanted to do to the record label and vice versa, you know, when Michael and the label weren't necessarily speaking the same language. And you know, they together had, Michael in particular, had some P.T. Barnum in him, you know. He would come up with these ways to get attention, and DeLeo would support him on this stuff. And that's where, you know, the early kind of quote-unquote weirdness that was in Michael's life, you know, the hyperbaric chamber and the elephant man's bones and all those early stories
yeah.
kind of popped into the media and the tabloids. It was just sort of like a way to get attention. But, you know, then it sort of turned into something much more sinister, I think. And then Michael became known as this guy who was weird in a negative way. And then, you know, you started to see this wacko jacko stuff in the tabloids all over the world, and quite nasty in a way, I think unfair to Michael. And then, you know, certainly you could argue that kind of leads to the child molestation accusations. And it didn't help, of course, that Michael made a few major errors of judgment that we alluded to earlier.
Was Michael Jackson aware of the piece of art that Jeff Koons had displayed of him in white porcelain with his chimp bubbles?
I'm not sure about that. I don't know the answer to that.
That'd be interesting to know. You mentioned speaking the language. Now, you know, you also say in your book that Michael had kind of a weird way of speaking. He was difficult to understand. How would you put it?
Well, I don't know if it was difficult to understand with the people around him. I mean, he obviously spoke in this high pitch, and in fact, his vocal coach Seth Riggs told me that, you know, he had to sort of work with Michael to have him talk in a more grown up register, a lower register, because it wasn't good for his voice to constantly be speaking so high. So that was something that Michael had to work on in his regular speech after a certain point in his career. But as far as, like, people not being able to understand him, I think that speaks maybe more to the judgment issue again. I mean, I think that after a certain point, certainly starting in the mid-90s perhaps, I think Michael was starting to make decisions that were particularly spending decisions. You know, he just wanted to spend money and not worry about the budget, and there's a lot of evidence for this. And so he would want to, you know, spend more money that was ever been made on music video, ever been spent on music videos or albums or tracks, and you know, in his personal life as well, and that got him into a lot of trouble later.
That resulted in you said at the time of his death he owed $400 million or something.
Yeah, I don't have the number in front of me, but he owed a lot of money, and in part the reason that he agreed to do these final concerts for the This Is It tour with the promoter AEG. Was because he needed to be able to spend the way he wanted to spend. He needed to get out of debt.
Now, Michael Jackson had some unusual best friends, like Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor. How did he choose his friends? How did they get involved with him? Would you think Michael was an intelligent guy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely he was an intelligent guy. I mean, I think that Michael just kind of sought people out at a certain point, and sometimes they sought him out. I mean, he and Elizabeth Taylor bonded because they both had this shared background of being child stars, you know, and I think that I think to an extent he was kind of looking for a mother figure or with her a little bit, perhaps. And she, you know, she was someone who could kind of speak his language, you know, she certainly had a very deep connection with him. You know, she realized that as a Jehovah's Witness growing up, his mother was Jehovah's Witness, he never really got to experience the traditional Christmas, for example. So she took it upon herself to sort of throw Michael this Christmas party that had the presents and the tree and all the trimmings, and he loved that. And she bought him an elephant for the Neverland Ranch that went into his menagerie, and really, you know, was one of the few people who could really not only bond with him and get to him on a personal level, but had the means to be able to do that as well.
What about Brando?
Brando, I mean, was just someone that Michael had kind of befriended over the years. And, you know, I'm not sure, I don't think they had quite as close of a relationship with Elizabeth Taylor, but they certainly encountered each other and knew each other and were close.
Watched movies and ate popcorn, that's what I heard.
Correct, yeah.
Well, maybe Michael did that with a lot of people.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a when he was at Neverland Ranch, beginning in the late 80s, early 90s, he would sort of summon people, you know, and sometimes they were famous people, and sometimes, you know, I had this anecdote in my book where a well-known video director comes over to visit him, and Michael loves his work, and you know, this gentleman and his wife came over, and Michael says, "Hey, you want to go see a movie in my Neverland movie theater?" And the couple says, "Sure, yeah, let's do that. We'd love to do that." And Michael says, "Is it okay if my friend Greg joins us?" "Yeah, sure, fine, bring Greg." And it turns out Greg is Gregory Peck. So these people, you know, went to the movies with Michael Jackson and Gregory Peck. And so that was one of the more fun things. I mean, of course, Neverland had a little bit of a sinister story later, but you know, there was a period when people would come to the Neverland Ranch, and it was like going into Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. And I talked to a lot of people who had a lot of very funny stories about that.
You express a little regret in your book, I think, that the Neverland Ranch just kind of disappeared and was turned into just an ordinary piece of property. Would you have rather that it been turned into a Michael Jackson Memorial amusement park?
I don't know. I've seen the argument. You know, I follow one of Michael's close friends, who was his makeup artist, Karen Fay, on Twitter. Although she didn't talk to me, she doesn't give interviews to the media. But she's sort of made the point on Twitter, and I think it's a fair one, that, you know, Neverland should stay in the family. You know, and even though financial decisions have happened, some caused by Michael, some caused by other people, that kind of moved it out of his heir's control. And now, you know, it's up for sale. I think that it's such an iconic place that it should have been Michael and his family's choice to be able to do with it what they will. You know, whether or not it becomes a theme park, I'm not sure that's practical. I mean, you know, you can turn Graceland into a theme park because it's in the middle of downtown Memphis, you know, and there's ways to kind of keep the crowds under control there. Neverland Ranch is kind of like in the middle of nowhere, and there's all these rich people's plots of lands all around it, ranchers and so forth, and everybody likes to be quiet there, and there's like one dirt road that leads to Neverland. So if all of a sudden you have this pilgrimage of hundreds of millions of people, you know, going to Disneyland, I'm not sure that works out practically.
Well, we're only just scratched the surface, of course, of the genius of Michael Jackson, and does a very good job of returning Michael to his rightful place as a great force in American popular music. And Steve Knopper, thank you for spending some time talking about it with us on From the Bookshelf.
Absolutely. I enjoyed the conversation very much. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Steve Knopper. His book, MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.